Afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We do have a quorum. I call a meeting of the House Transportation Finance Committee to order. Representative Johnson, do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that we approve the minutes from Thursday, February 9th.
Thank you. Johnson moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. Minutes are approved. We are ready for our first presentation of the day. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Schottauer. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm the Director of the Office of Transit for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Today I'll give you an overview of Greater Minnesota Transit, and then I'll be followed by some of our local partners that will give their perspective on it.
Thank you.
I'll start by just telling you what Greater Minnesota Transit is. It's 42.
Excuse me. Let's get that mic turned up a little bit.
Is it not? Is it me or is it Mike?
Well, it's probably a little of each. But I blame it on the mic if
all
I
were
you.
Not for it. Thank you. Thank you. So, if anybody missed it, I'm Mike Schottauer. I'm the Director of the Office of Transit for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And I'm going to talk about Greater Minnesota Transit for you today. So what is Greater Minnesota Transit? It's 43 locally managed and operated transit systems that cover all of Minnesota outside the seven-county metro area. They vary greatly. They range from really small systems like the one that serves the municipality of Fauston, where there's just one bus doing Guiler Ride service, all the way up to Arrowhead Transit, which covers eight counties in the northeast part of the state. And it would cover an area as large as the 10th largest state in the United States if it were a state itself. And they run dial-a-ride and deviated route service there. Greater Minnesota Transit also has urban routes, much like Metro Transit in the Twin Cities, in places like St. Cloud, Rochester, Duluth, and they run fixed route service, just like Metro Transit. In addition to that, and just like Metro Transit, anybody that runs fixed route service is required by federal law to also run a complimentary paratransit service that helps people with disabilities access transit when they can't otherwise get to a fixed route bus. And then finally, there's many transit systems that serve rural areas, and they might also be serving municipal areas, and they could cover areas as small as one county or as large as several counties as Arrowhead does. As I said, these systems are all managed and operated locally. MnDOT's role is to grant them federal and state funds to help them with their operations. We also help set statewide goals through planning processes that I'll be talking about in a moment. Every county in Minnesota has at least some public transit service today, although in several counties that might not cover the whole county. And in many places, even where it does cover all the county, it might only visit that part of a county one or two or three days a month. So who rides Greater Minnesota Transit? Well, it's people going to work, school, medical appointments, shopping, or going to social events. As you can see from this chart, over the last 10 years, ridership in Greater Minnesota Transit has risen about 25%. We don't have 2016 numbers, I'll just mention, because, we work with local partners, so part of the requirements for our local partners is to submit their data about the last year by the end of March of the next year. So we're still receiving those reports, and we'll have those compiled shortly after March 31st. So what are the statewide goals for Minnesota Transit? Well, the legislature set a goal in 2009 when it instructed the Department of Transportation to do a Greater Minnesota Transit Investment Plan. It instructed MnDOT to determine the cost of meeting 100% of transit need, but it set a goal of trying to meet 90% of transit need by 2025. MnDOT first did a Greater Minnesota Transit Investment Plan in 2011, and we're now doing our second iteration of that. So much of the data you'll hear from me is from our work on this second iteration of the investment plan. And we've published that for public comments so far. We're reacting to those public comments right now before we publish it again for some more comments and then final. A little bit more about the goal. It's something that not only will be incorporated into that investment plan, but it's also incorporated into other plans that MnDOT is involved with on a statewide basis. A very important one of those is called the Olmsted Plan. And for anybody that hasn't heard about that, it's really important because it has court-ordered requirements to help people with disabilities be better integrated into society. That may have a profound impact on transit in Minnesota, and here's an example of how that would be. Currently, people with disabilities often work together in a co-location, and it's very easy for transit to pick up the people from where they live and bring them to one place. But with the opportunities of the Olmsted Plan, people with disabilities will be able to choose to work in a more integrated setting, meaning they're not all working at the same place, and that will put a great challenge out there for transportation to get them from wherever they live to wherever they choose to work. Another plan that goal of meeting 90% of need by 2025 is incorporated into is called Heading Home, which is a multi-agency effort to prevent and end homelessness in Minnesota. So as part of the investment plan, we had to develop a model to forecast need in order to comply with the legislator's requirement. So we've worked with consultants who are experts at using models, and they pulled from national models and customized one for Minnesota that uses demographic information about seniors, individuals with disabilities, carless households, and then it also has factors to account for the presence of things like county seats or college campuses that can also increase transit need. So that model has forecasted a need for 18.9 million transit trips by 2025 to meet 100% of need. So the goal, again, is to meet 90% of that by 2025. That would mean about 17 million trips. And for comparison, in that chart I showed you earlier, Greater Minnesota delivered about 12.2 million trips in 2015. So we need to produce about 4.8 million trips by 2025, more trips. Based on the way people ride buses and how many people are in a bus and the hours that those buses run, that corresponds to about 1.7 million hours of service that would need to be offered in Greater Minnesota by 2025. And again, to compare, Minnesota offered about 1.2 million hours in 2015. So we need to grow by about 500,000 hours of service by 2015 to meet the goal. So does adding 500,000 hours of service make sense? We think it does, and it's based on what we learned with the public outreach that we conducted during the Greater Minnesota Transit Investment Plan effort. So what we heard from people is that they need transit to get to work, but that a lot of the transit systems that operate around Minnesota today aren't offering a broad enough set of hours, a span of service, as we call it, to go to work and come home from work on transit. A lot of transit systems will only offer service maybe from 9 to 4, and it's pretty hard to fit a whole workday into that. And also a lot of transit systems across Minnesota don't have Saturday or Sunday service, including even Rochester, a large city that doesn't have any Sunday transit service. Another way that people needed is to get to medical appointments and just to be able to remain living in their homes, so to have shopping and other opportunities to get from their homes for life supplies. Transit's often a lifeline for older people that can't drive, but they still want to remain living in their homes. So we looked at these needs from people, and we looked at the service that's out there today and started adding up the kind of services that would help meet these needs. So the first one is to increase the span of service, which is, again, to provide more hours of service to the day. And we put together a guideline for transit systems to work from that would be based on the size of a community. So we're trying to strive for service that would be in large communities, 20 hours a day on a weekday, and then about 12 hours a day on a Saturday and 9 hours on a Sunday, for example. And then in smaller communities, those hours are reduced or maybe not at all on some days, like Sundays, depending on the size of the community. So we know that would produce about 270,000 hours of service if those things were added by 2025. We also looked at other kinds of service that would be needed, and those include things like serving areas that aren't currently receiving any kind of transit service, adding the ADA paratransit that would be needed in communities that have fixed route to correspond with the added other service. Again, that's a federal requirement that the ADA paratransit be as good as the fixed route service around it. We would also be adding some better frequency for urban areas. A lot of transit systems in our urban areas are only able to produce one trip or one bus per hour, even in peak hours, and we'd like to see that get to a 30-minute service. And we'd like to add some more regional express commuter routes to help people get into those communities, as well as adding some more service that connect rural areas to trade centers so that people can get there for medical or shopping needs. So if you add up all those different hours of those kinds of services, it does add up to right at 500,000 hours of service. So it does seem to us to make sense to how the model works compared to what kind of service is missing out there.
Mr. Shadow, I'm going to interrupt you for a moment. We have a couple of questions. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schadauer?
Yes.
Thank you for your presentation. Tell us more. So it seems that the department is really the originator of the determination of need here. I've heard about this calculation or this approach that you have, an index or whatever it is you develop. I've never seen the actual numbers for it. I'm curious who it was developed and how MnDOT suddenly became the determiner of need.
Mr. Schadauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Well, first, to answer how MnDOT's the determiner of need, I guess we're interpreting the legislation that instructed us to calculate the need to be kind of appointing us to have that responsibility. And then the model that we use for this is there's kind of base models that are used across the country. They usually use demographic data similar to what we're using. They usually get customized because they compare what the model would produce for years where services already existed to calibrate them and make sure that it makes sense for the service that's already going on up there and the ridership that's happening. And then some of that customization involves some of the things that I described. So when I talked about how county seats impact it, that seems to be a bigger difference for Minnesota than some other other states, so that was a factor that they felt was important to add for Minnesota. Similarly with college campuses, that really generates a lot of ridership in Minnesota, so they made sure that that was part of it. So it's really drawing on national expertise and fitting it to the locality where they're working.
So, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Schadauer, there's actually legislation that was written into law somewhere that says that MnDOT will determine the need. Is that what you said?
Mr. Schadauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't want to say it that specifically because I don't remember the exact wording, but in 2009, the legislature passed a law requiring MnDOT to develop a Greater Minnesota Transit Investment Plan, and it required MnDOT to estimate the costs to meet 100% of the transit need for 2015, 2020, 2025, every five-year increment, and then also to include goals of meeting 80% of transit need by 2015 and 90% of transit need by 2025. So we interpreted that to tell us to estimate the need.
Thank you, Mr. Schadauer, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Burris, are you digging into this, or are you just doing some recreational reading over there?
Mr. Chair, a little bit of both. So the provision that Mr. Schadauer is referring to is in one of the chapters of statute that's MnDOT. It's kind of MnDOT governing MnDOT goals and agency activities, and it's on public transit. So it's section 174.24. This is a provision, as Mr. Schadauer identified, that lays out a requirement of MnDOT establishing a transit investment plan meeting service needs by 2015 and then 2025. And the statute also lays out some of the requirements of what the plan would need to include.
Thank you, Mr. Burris. Sorry to put you on the spot. I have another question from Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Schadauer. I'm wondering if when you look at the need, is it for a full round trip? And is that what you're basing things on? And does a half trip, you know what I mean, a one-way trip count? Because I'm thinking of grandma or somebody, you know, well, if I can get to the mall, maybe you can meet me there, daughter-in-law, son-in-law, whatever, and take me home. So to me, there's a one-way trip is virtually almost as good sometimes for many people. So how do you factor in and calculate that aspect of it? Because I'm certain there's got to be a high percentage that are actually one-way trips.
Mr. Shadar.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the trips that I'm talking about are all one-way trips. So we're not paying attention to whether it turns out to be a round trip as far as the modeling goes. It's just one-way trips.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Shadar. You had a slide titled Who Rides Greater Minnesota Public Transit, a bar graph, and it looks like there was a pretty significant increase between 2006 and 2015. What specifically do you attribute that increase to, or several, you know, maybe multiple factors?
Mr. Shadar.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the ridership growth has been a number of factors. Part of it is that there's more service on the street over those years, so there's more service available. Part of it that has happened in the last 10 years and we expect to happen at an accelerated pace in the next 10 years is the aging of Greater Minnesota. There's just more people that can't drive themselves that are out there. Some of the other things are just the good efforts of the local transit agencies to work with people in their communities or colleges in their communities so that there are more contracts with colleges so that when students enroll, they get a transit pass that helps them get between classes or from home to class. It's many factors like that.
Representative Hornstein.
And thank you, and maybe you'll get into this later, but and this is not under your jurisdiction because it's private providers, but, you know, we have service, you know, inter-city service via bus. And do you see similar trends there? And I think, unfortunately, I think it's somewhat limited in terms of getting from point A to point B, like from the Twin Cities to points in Greater Minnesota or points within Greater Minnesota on bus. Are you seeing similar trends in that service, you know, the Jefferson service, for example, from, you know, the Twin Cities to Wilmer, you know, things of that nature?
Mr. Shadar.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know the answer to that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I hope at some point, you know, it's not something that we've talked about in this committee very much, you know, over the years that I've been on it, which is since 2003. But I think that there's an interesting conversation to take place about getting from point A to point B within Greater Minnesota outside of one county to another, and certainly from the Twin Cities to regional centers and other places. So, you know, it would be interesting to get some info on that, and I don't know if it's who would be able to provide it, but I think it's a good conversation.
Well, thank you, Representative Hornstein. That exact topic came up at my town hall meetings a little over a week ago. Of someone who wanted to come to the Capitol but needed public transit to do it, and, of course, very limited availability.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting question. We have a question from Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Shadar. I had the opportunity to sit on a meeting in St. Peter where there's some regional transit expansion going on, and I thought, to be honest, I thought MnDOT really was an effective partner in that meeting and helping to assure those people there that you'll stay with us, and also that you were listening to some alternatives because they're looking at multiple ways to deliver the service using a volunteer ride service through a Vine and also using the St. Peter and Lake Sewer service. And I thought it was very creative. I'm thinking, though, going into the future, what kind of support can they expect or other areas like that expect from MnDOT as they work to determine those needs and meet those needs in slightly different ways?
Mr. Shadar.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're fortunate to have on our staff what we call district transit project managers. So they're project managers that work with transit systems like you're describing, that are situated around Greater Minnesota in six different locations. So those people are there to help when transit systems are developing, as you described, or as transit systems are maturing and just need advice about how to improve a route so it serves people better, or all those kinds of things.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. question is kind of for the director, and we see this more in the Metro, that Metro Transit offers free rides, and to Representative Hornstein's kind of question about the increase in ridership. Do some of the greater Minnesota transit providers offer free rides on holidays or special events?
Mr. Schadauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, honestly, I don't know. And just to give you a little bit behind why I don't know is that what we're responsible for keeping track of is that the local match gets made for the grants that we give out, and it's up to the local communities to decide how to set their fare structures and whether they have, you know, certain events that offer free service. What we're paying attention to is that they're complying with our grant contracts.
A follow-up?
No, thank you very much.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to comment on the graph that you have up there right now, it looks like there was great growth from 2006 to 2008. Of course, we had the recession in 2009-10, which kind of reduced. But since 2008, really you're looking only like about a 1% a year growth there. And that may have to do with just the availability of things not really changing much in next years. But going back on to what you were talking about when you finished discussions at this point, about 500,000 hours of service, it makes sense to improve that. That certainly would allow for continued growth. But my question revolves around, was there any research, or are you aware of any research as to determine where the best return on investment or utilization or effectiveness would provide those 500,000 hours, rather than just always planning on it being the department rather than a private industry or counties or et cetera?
Mr. Schadauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what you're describing is how it's kind of the tightrope we walk very frequently in making our funding decisions. So we have efficiency standards where we're asking certain kinds of service to serve a certain number of passengers per hour. So like dial-a-ride should be at least 3 passengers per hour. Urban service should be 12 passengers per hour minimum. So we're walking the line between making sure that efficiency gets carried through and that we provide access to as many people as we can. So we try to keep them at those standards, but we recognize that there's local decisions being made here, and if they can run some routes that are above those standards to balance out some routes that are worse than those standards, they're meeting our expectations. We and the local people that we partner with are always looking for local partners for some of the other services that you're describing. So it might be part of the transit system, or it might be part of their county government where there's volunteer rides available. And they'll refer people back and forth according to which service best meets their need. Similarly, one of the initiatives we're working on right now with other agencies in Minnesota is to try to put together what we're calling regional transportation coordinating councils. And those would be resources where people could call or maybe click in to a resource that might serve 8 to 10 counties and get information about what kind of transportation resources are there, whether public or private, and steer people to whatever system works best for them based on maybe what programs help them as well from other agencies.
Quick follow-up, Representative Petersburg.
Yeah, thank you. And that kind of speaks to my other question. Do you feel that your plan and the system that is put in place can react quick enough with technological advances and options that may be coming down the forefront into the future?
Mr. Schadauer, and urge you to move quickly. We're running out of time.
All right, Mr. Chair, Representative. We're paying very close attention to what technology is doing right now. For example, we see what Uber does for making a user interface very easy for people. We'd like to see that eventually be a kind of a tool that could be used for getting a dial-a-ride. We're also paying attention to what self-driving vehicles could mean, especially for helping people with disabilities get around, but how it could change the whole transit industry as well. But what we know is what we can put into this plan today.
Representative Mason has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had mentioned Uber. And I guess my question is that service or similar services having any impact in greater Minnesota?
Mr. Schadauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so far Uber, as far as I know, and it's been a couple of months since I checked, only served the Twin Cities area and the Fargo-Moorhead area, so it's had very little impact in greater Minnesota so far.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a quick question for the testifier. What is the cost that's charged to the rider per trip?
Mr. Schadauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, again, that varies greatly from transit system to transit system. Again, we're paying attention to that they complete their local match for our grant, and whether they get their local match from fares or from contracts with transportation service they provide, advertising, local taxes is up to them.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Schadauer, I'm just wondering if there's been any thought going into the impact of a border-to-border broadband system in the state of Minnesota, where we'd be using telecommuting and telemedicine as well to reduce the need and reduce the cost. Has this entered into your planning at all?
Mr. Schadauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative. It hasn't entered into our planning in any great degree. We are certainly aware that telecommuting opportunities and medical, electronic medical opportunities could change the demand in the future. But again, it's really hard to throw that into a forecast without knowing very much about it today.
A final question from Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the questions I have is, I'm assuming you're familiar with the Office of Economic Security for Women, not sure the exact name of it, that's here in Minnesota. And they did 8 listening sessions across greater Minnesota. 51 organizations participated, a lot of residents across Minnesota. And I wanted to know in the number one economic security issue that came out of those listening sessions for women is transportation. And I'm wondering, how did you incorporate those findings into your plan?
Mr. Schadauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I have to confess that I was not aware of that. But what I believe you were describing for their concerns matches very closely with what the concerns that we've been hearing from the disabled community as part of the Olmsted Plan work that we're doing. And that's part of why Greater Minnesota Transit is so important for mobility for people and safety for people, is making sure that there's ways to get places where they need to go.
Representative Bernardi.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Schadauer, I would like to, I don't know how to go about this, but when we have an Office of the Status of Minnesota, I would like that information incorporated into your planning, and I don't know how to make that happen, but it's very important that the needs of women and their transportation needs are met, and it's critical that it's incorporated into your planning work. Thank you.
Thank you for that comment. Go ahead with your presentation.
All right. So going back to what we've learned for the needed added service, this chart depicts the service hours that have been out there for the last 10 years in blue and the service hours that we would like to strive for by 2025 in green. So that's that 500,000 hours added on. You can see that we've been increasing at that rate since about 2012, and we want to continue that. One of the things that we're doing right now is looking at a program that would accelerate some of this growth, so instead of just being a linear growth from 2016 on, maybe we can get some higher bars in the near future to provide more service more quickly to the people and still be striving towards that 2025 goal. So how is Greater Minnesota Public Transit funded? We get funds from the Federal Transit Administration, from the General Fund, and from the Motor Vehicle Sales Tax and the Leased Motor Vehicle Sales Tax. And then that's combined with the local funds that I've just mentioned a few times that are raised through fares, operating contracts, advertising, and local taxes. So this chart illustrates the grantable funds that we've had available for the last 10 years and what we would expect to have available for the next 10 based on the FAST Act from federal perspective, the base level for our general fund, and then MMB forecasts for the 2 sales taxes through 2021, and then we're just assuming some flat or up to 2% growth beyond that. It's interesting to note how that kind of flattens out relative to the service hours that we're trying to strive for in our last chart, and that's an important determinator then in how we've been included in the governor's transportation funding proposal. So to achieve that 90% of need by 2025, we would have to have about $120 million more over the 10-year period from 2018 to 2027 as the governor's proposal suggests. And the governor's also suggesting that that starts with $10 million at the beginning of the period and then grows later in the period to achieve the $120 million over those 10 years. And with that, I will stand for any more questions that you would have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Schadauer. I don't see any more questions right now. We have a number of other testifiers that would like to address this issue, so you may be called back to help with answer questions as we move forward. Thank you for your presentation. Next, I have Sherry Munyon, I believe, up to speak, and then Craig Remp will be next after that. Or maybe you're testifying together. I don't know. Very good. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Sherry Munyon, and I represent the Minnesota Public Transit Association. And with me today are two providers from the association who will follow up and describe some of their local efforts and challenges that they're facing. MPTA, the Public Transit Association, is a statewide coalition of transit providers throughout the state of Minnesota. And services for their members include training as well as legislative advocacy for their both their policy and finance needs. As you know, public transit is a critical element of Minnesota's transportation system. I won't repeat some of the comments that were already made by Michael Schadauer about the growing need and demand for transit that he stated. But as you know, that with the growing population and with the aging population, statutory goals and Olmstead Plan, there are some needs that need to see service expanded, both in geography as well as in hours as we look into the future. And I want to call your attention to a handout. There's a three-page handout from MPTA that has some more facts and figures in it, including a couple on page 2 that I'd call your attention to, that transit users in greater Minnesota are riding 5 days a week, 50% of our riders, 86% of them are riding twice a week, 33% of riders outside of the metropolitan area are going to work, and another 20% are using work trips. The second handout in your packet is a list of counties and the transit providers. So if you aren't already aware of your county transit systems, you'll find them covered on the list. And also, Mike Schadauer mentioned the Olmstead Plan, and we've included just the one pager that looks at integrating the Olmstead Plan into transportation as we move forward. Support for adequate funding in greater Minnesota transit systems is extremely important to increase service and meet their growing needs, while at the same time, they're struggling to provide higher wages for their bus drivers so they can make a livable wage above the poverty line. They are competing with businesses like Walmart and can't find drivers because the pay scale is lower in many communities. Also, an effort to provide adequate benefits to staff so they can avoid applying for county assistance, which we have in some cases, covering more expenses to help drivers with their required certification and medical certificates, providing incentives to attract transit staff throughout the region, and even supporting our local taxi service and specialty providers to stay busy when there aren't enough trips and mileage reimbursement to cover insurance costs. So we're looking to keep fares affordable to make sure every resident has access to work, school, medical appointments, and keep them a participant in their local economy. I'm going to touch briefly on legislative agenda for the Public Transit Association. Our members include rural transit systems, of course, but also Metrobus and our suburban transit providers. And for the metropolitan area, we're urging an increase in funding for our systems and also include support for 3-year authorization for regional bonds, an appropriation of $4.5 million for the suburb-to-suburb bus service that you'll hear more about when they testify, and a metro sales tax increase with dedication of a percentage of that to grow the bus service in the metropolitan area for all of our contract providers as well. In Greater Minnesota, we continue to advocate for the dedication of the $32 million that currently sits in the general fund to be split 50-50 between the five suburban providers and the Greater Minnesota Transit System. This is obviously important in having a dedicated growing source of funding that systems can rely on and look to the future. It is important for them in their local planning when they have to go before their county and city boards to secure local match to be able to let them know that future funding is available from the state for that match. The past several years, most of our systems struggled providing a higher match than was required by law. Many of our systems were putting in 30% local share of revenue when the statute for our urban systems only required them to provide a 20% share, and the same was true for some of the smaller shares. Due to the support of the legislature the last couple of years, systems are finally seeing themselves able to get back down to a local share that's in line with the statute. And just want to make a special thanks to Representative Kosnick for carrying the lease vehicle revenue bill. And we look forward to meeting with all of you. Some of you will have appointments on Thursday for transit members. That'll be at the Capitol. And I'll turn it over to Craig Grimp, the president of MIPTA and the director of the Chisago-Isanti Heartland.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead. You might want to scoot over a little closer to the microphone so we can hear you easily.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Craig Remp. I'm the transit director for Chisago-Isanti County Heartland Express and also president of MIPTA. Speaking of our service here first real quick, let's see. Our service area is the counties of Chisago and Isanti, and we have connections in Anoka, Pine, and Mille Lacs County. In the year 2016, we provided just under 80,000 rides, and those are one-way trips. Pretty much all of us, you know, rate things in that way. Our passengers include the transit dependent, shoppers, college students, disabled, school kids, summer programs. Most all the systems have contracts with DTNHs or DACs. Then we also, for us, being so close to the cities, we have other links. We have professional commuters going to downtown Minneapolis and St. Paul that we have extension routes that connect up to MTC routes. And then daycares and those type of facilities, we do special trips for them. They go on field trips, stuff like that. There's a lot of more lists to that. That's kind of the highlight. The two largest groups out of that is work-related trips and school trips. They represent, in our system, 49.7% of the rides. So that's the two largest areas. Some of the challenges we face, and these are both because of local and state issues of why these challenges are there, but it's to provide the needed service in rural Minnesota, these challenges. Some of the unmet needs we face are as follows. Number one, more access for the DTNH clients or DHS clients, school kids, college students, and employment-related rides. We're always fighting the issue. They all ride the same time. There's never enough buses or time to pick everyone up, so we're denying rides there or having to try to shift rides to different hours of the day. Another challenge we're doing is being able to provide services in areas that we do not cover. Our counties basically are Chisago and Isanti County. We do not cover all of the county. We cover probably on the outside, I might be pushing it here, 50% of the two counties. The rest of it is a little too far out, not enough time, not enough buses, not enough drivers. So there's a large unmet need in those farther outreaches of the counties. Another challenge is bus fleet condition. We currently have, we officially have a 12-bus fleet. We keep 13 to 14 buses in our fleet. One or two buses are supposed to sell. We drag that out as long as we can to have a backup bus in case something happens. Out of those 13 buses we're running, five of them are beyond the federal standards for state of good repair. Those standards are 180,000 miles or 5 years and or. We currently, those five buses start at 225,000 And the highest one goes up to 390,000 miles. And they are on a six-year replacement plan. So that's, and that's kind of typical around the state too. For, that's a big challenge for us to keep the buses up and running. Another one is qualified staff and drivers. There's been several others allude to that here. We're having a lot of difficulties finding, hiring, and retaining. The drivers, for an example, just yesterday I looked in the paper, have two applications for new drivers. We're offering $14.75. The school bus departments are offering $16.88. And the CDL listing, their listing was right under ours. CDL was right next to the school bus, up to $65,000 a year, $7,500 signing bonus, medical benefits on day one. It's very hard to get anyone to even look at our ad with those two sitting right next to it. Our operations coordinator and accounting position we have, we fill them, but it's always temporary jobs. Same thing, our pay scale is so low, within a 3 or 4 month period, they're already looking for other jobs and moving on because they can get paid better. Excuse me. So in order to be able to expand our services to meet ADA, Olmstead, and the governor's 90% goal, we will need more buses, staff, facilities, and operating capital. The local match is hard to find if we can find it. At times, it's hard to even get any commitment for local matches. Without dedicated funding that will increase throughout the years, it can't just be now. It's got to be increased step-wise as the years go on. These goals will never be met. I do want to address real quick a couple of questions.
Mr. Rimp, we have a very limited amount of time, so if you could hurry through your presentation.
We can let it go. Thank you.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Tom Cruikshank. I'm the Chief Operations Officer for Metrobus in St. Cloud, also known as the St. Cloud Metropolitan Transit Commission. We are one of the urban transit providers in greater Minnesota. We have one of the larger fleets and staffs of the urban systems. We provide over 2.1 million trips a year to quite a wide variety of users in the St. Cloud area. In our service area, we provide a large number of college student trips with St. Cloud State University and St. Cloud Technical and Community College in St. Cloud. They provide about 40% of our ridership annually, so they're a very important partner. Something maybe to touch on there is we've had a longstanding agreement with St. Cloud State and the Technical College to provide service to those students under a UPass-type program. Not a whole lot different than what's done in Duluth and the Twin Cities, Fargo-Moorhead, and other college communities in and around our state. It's very common for colleges to want to do that with their local transit systems because it's campuses don't want to be auto-dominated. They want to be pedestrian-friendly campuses. Transit contributes to that, and we promote that idea in St. Cloud, thus our longstanding agreement with St. Cloud State. One of the challenges, however, we face is that it's a heavily subsidized fare structure to allow those students to access our system by simply swiping their student ID on the bus and riding. It's a challenge that we face and creates a financial hardship on us as the operator, but something we don't certainly want to give up because if we had to change that program, it would certainly impact our ridership in a very negative way. So whatever help the committee here can certainly provide to us urban operators that have those types of programs is certainly appreciated to keep us financially sound so that we can continue to provide, you know, those high levels of service. One of the other challenges that we face is that we are also an urban hub for people with disabilities and older adults that are maybe leaving small towns. Some of you that represent small communities probably see that, where maybe you have a lack of services for those people to live in your community. They're going to places like St. Cloud. But it puts pressure on our service structure to provide rides for those people for medical appointments and social appointments and jobs and other types of trips that they take. So we have a lot of pressure on our system. Mike would certainly represent that in his discussion, and that MnDOT also has to, you know, look at systems like ours because we consume a lot of resources when you combine all the urban operators in Minnesota compared to the smaller operators around the state. So we are on a growth pattern. We completed last year an update to our long-range plan. Mike mentioned about 500,000 hours of additional transit service. There's an expectation for St. Cloud to be about 10% of that, about 50,000 hours just in our service area alone. That's a huge number of hours for us. That's going to equate to 30-plus additional drivers, probably 20 additional support staff, as many as 20 to 30 additional buses. You know, today I don't have the facilities or the accommodation for that. So I'm sure you'll see us here in front of your committee as time goes on asking for some additional assistance for us to be able to accommodate that growth into the future. So that, those are a couple of items that I wanted to present to you to kind of whet your palate of what's going on in greater Minnesota related to, you know, our system in St. Cloud. Happy to answer any questions, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Cruikshank. Just a couple of quick questions. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is to Greater Minnesota Services. I appreciate the service you provide. I think it's important. And in light of one of the House files that have been introduced this year, 1150, asking for fare recovery in the metropolitan area to be 80% by 2022, how do you, I can see that if that's going to happen in the metro area, I can see the potential that it will be passed statewide to have an 80% fare recovery. What is your fare recovery now, and how do you think that you would meet that expectation if it's passed into law?
Mr. Cruikshank.
Mr. Chair, member, in St. Cloud, we're at about 15% fare recovery, our fares and our contracts related to fares.
We're very short on time, Mr. Bernardi. You have a follow-up?
Chair, I had also asked the question, is how would you meet that goal if that bill is passed to also include Greater Minnesota?
Yes,
and what it would cost, what would be the cost benefits to you guys?
Mr. Chair, we probably have to increase fares or try to negotiate higher rates on our contracts with those entities like St. Cloud State that we have, that we provide service to. The chance, by doing that, though, you risk reducing your ridership when you raise your rates.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is also for Mr. Cruikshank. And there's a number of us in the Minnesota House who are interested in seeing the commuter rails expand from Big Lake up to St. Cloud. So if a rider gets on in the Twin Cities and gets to St. Cloud, they need to get around St. Cloud. Can you assure this committee that if that rider came, they could find a full set of services, that they could get good access to the city of St. Cloud?
Mr. Cruikshank.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, we already have that link in place. When you get off the train in Big Lake, you get on a North Star Link bus that we operate and provide that connection to St. Cloud, where you have a direct connection to our Metro bus services within our service area. So if the train someday does extend to St. Cloud, that network's already in place and those services are already there for those riders.
Very good. Thank you all for joining us today. We appreciate your presentation. We're going to move on to the Suburban Transit Association. Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. James Clark with Messerling Kramer, representing the Suburban Transit Association. Mr. Chair, with me today is Jerry McDonald, Chanhassen City Council member and also the current chair of the Suburban Transit Association, and Jen Lehman, who is the planning manager for Minnesota Valley Transit Authority. Mr. Chair, we would love the opportunity to provide the committee with a brief history of the Suburban Transit Association, some trends and growth that we see coming, and then also, Mr. Chair, update the committee on the 495 demonstration project that the legislature funded 2 years ago. It's a suburban demonstration project. So with that, Mr. Chair, if I could continue. Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, the Suburban Transit Association is made up of four transit providers. Maple Grove Transit, Plymouth Metrolink, Southwest Transit, which is the cities of Eden Prairie, Chanhassen, and Chaska, and then Minnesota Valley Transit Authority, which is made up of seven cities, including Burnsville, Apple Valley, Eagan, Rosemont, Savage, Prior Lake, and Shakopee. And, Mr. Chair, the suburban transit providers, back in 1984, the legislature passed a bill that allowed communities to, quote, opt out of the metropolitan system. And the reason for that, Mr. Chair, was those communities were not receiving transit service at the time. So there were a number of communities that did request that authorization and sought that authorization and were approved to provide their own transit systems in coordination with the rest of the region. Some cities chose to be independent transit operators, as such as Plymouth and Maple Grove, and others decided to jointly cooperate and provide service as joint powers. In 1995, the STA was founded, and that is to provide a unified voice to the legislature on suburban transit needs. Some of the benefits of the STA providers include a focus on peak period express service, satisfaction rates as high as 98% of their customers are satisfied with their service, and they've also received a number of awards from both the Minnesota Public Transit Association and the American Public Transit Association. The suburban providers like to think of innovation as one of the hallmarks of their service. Whether that would be the transit-oriented development, and you can see that in Maple Grove, you can see that out in Eden Prairie, you can see it in Eagan, where there's a not only is there a transit station, but there's also a component of businesses that provide where riders can access restaurants or dry cleaners or others. And that cooperation helps reduce the cost of providing that transit service in those locations. The suburban providers were the first to bring the coach buses to the region, as well as free Wi-Fi. And there was further discussion about Uber. There's a very interesting program going on currently with Southwest Transit called Southwest Prime, which is a demand service where people can go use technology, go online, and request a ride. And that has dramatically reduced the amount of no-shows and also has been very, very successful and very popular in the Southwest Transit communities. There's also use of penalties and incentives in provider contracts with Minnesota Valley Transit Authority, a willingness to try and test new routes and services, an ability to adapt quickly and nimbly to different conditions, and success through partnerships and community outreach, including local businesses, which you'll hear more about during the 495 suburb-to-suburb discussion. This is a map of the 12 communities that are served by the suburban transit providers, as well as a travel shed map. This is gives you an idea of where the riders are coming from. As you can see, it's not just within the 12 communities, but it's from folks outside of those communities as well are accessing the service. Mr. Chair, members, there has been a modest increase in ridership over the past year. That despite very historically low gas prices, that's a big indicator of riders when you're dealing with express service with commuters going downtown, primarily to Minneapolis and St. Paul. But despite that, despite the low gas prices, there has been a modest increase in ridership as well. And, Mr. Chair, with that, I would like to turn it over to the Suburban Transit Association Chair, Jerry McDonald, Chanhassen City Council Member.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of this committee, one of the things that the suburban transit
Excuse me, sir. If you could just scoot over towards the mic a little bit, that would make it easier for us to hear. And please identify yourself for the record and start over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jerry McDonald. I am on the Chanhassen City Council, and I am currently the chair of the Suburban Transit Association. One of the things that the suburban providers do is to provide connections for our riders with places. In this slide, you can see a number of institutions that we provide rides to, the University of Minnesota. We now have connections to the Mall of America. We do state fair rides to, again, help our customers get out to the state fair during that period. We also do rides to the Twins games, to the Vikings games, and to numerous other activities that take place throughout the year. As the next slide shows, what has happened is that the population increase out in the southwest suburbs has continued to increase at a faster pace than it does within the seven-county metropolitan region. Part of this is due to the fact that there are more jobs are coming out to that area, more people are moving out to the area, so that there is a direct need for public transportation to get people to places out in the southwest region. One of the things, too, that we look at is, again, jobs. Again, looking at this slide, we have service getting us to Shakopee, Shutterfly. That's one of the things on the 494 that you'll hear a little bit more about. Eden Prairie, Minnetonka, Plymouth, also down to Maple Grove and Eagan. So in all of these areas over the past couple of years, businesses have relocated to these suburbs, and in the process of doing that they have created numerous jobs that do need to be filled. One of the things that we also do is to try to go between suburbs. In Eden Prairie, what we had worked on was to work with Target and their corporate headquarters. We had set up a route there. That was the probably the beginning or the genesis of the idea that we do need to look at suburb-to-suburb transportation needs. If we look at connecting people to jobs, again, what this shows is that the average employment increase within our area has again, gone up by over 50% compared to the rest of the seven-county metropolitan region. So we are seeing more growth in jobs. We're seeing more companies that do wish to relocate to the southwest suburbs. Each of the highlights, I'll go through these real briefly for you, but Southwest Transit, one of the big things that Southwest did was, again, I think the thing they look at the best was the Southwest Prime expansion. You talked about Uber. This is a direct attempt to bring the Uber model down to public transportation. And I would refer you, there was an article in the Star Tribune about 2-3 weeks ago that looked at this and the advantage of this service over a dial-a-ride service. Plymouth has also done a number of things. One of the things that Plymouth has done, they have now taken in-house the management and the oversight of their transportation's commission or their transportation system. Prior to this, Southwest Transit, via a contract, did the management for Plymouth. This past year, all that was turned over, and it's all now completely in-house with Plymouth running their transportation, their public transportation. Maple Grove has also done a number of things, again, looking to become more efficient, that they have done detailed analysis of travel times, and again, in an attempt to try to reduce service costs. Minnesota Valley Transit, again, the big thing that for Minnesota Valley during this past year has been the 495 demonstration project. And one of the things that the STA looked at, we went back and basically saw that probably the most, efficient route to look at was from the Mall of America down to Shakopee, where a number of corporations had resettled, one of which is Amazon, Shutterfly, and also Mystic Lake. There were quite a few number of jobs in that area. What we had been told by, again, talking to businesses, is a problem that they have is getting employees to work. So we looked at this route. Minnesota Valley took on this task. It goes from the Mall of America down through Burnsville out to Shakopee. So it is entirely within their area, but they have the support of the rest of the Suburban Transit Association. We're all kind of in this together. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Jen Lehman, who will talk to you a little bit more about the 494 project. Thank
please,
you.
Please identify yourself for the record. Go ahead.
Sure. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jen Lehman. I am planning manager with Minnesota Valley Transit Authority, and I'm going to wrap up our presentation by speaking about the 495 suburb-to-suburb demonstration project that STA was able to put on the road through the funding provided in the 2015 legislative session. This project has been a great opportunity to test a new service concept and to serve a new market in our region. For those of you who are not familiar with Route 495, it does provide express service between the Mall of America and Shakopee with limited stops. So there's also a stop at Burnsville Transit Station, and then select trips serve Amazon Distribution Center in Shakopee directly. The concept was developed by working with several key employers in Shakopee, and service began on August 20th of 2016, so just over, 6 months ago or so. We have 41 trips per day that operate 7 days a week, and one big request that we heard from employers was the need for Thanksgiving and Christmas Day service, which we were able to provide in the 2016 season. Service span is approximately 4 in the morning until 11 at night, typically hourly, with additional frequency during some of the peak trips. One unique piece to the service is that we did tailor the trip times specifically to the employer shifts. So a lot of times in a transit schedule, you'll see that the trips begin, you know, on the hour, on, you know, three after the hour, things like that. This schedule is specifically tailored to when shifts are beginning and ending for those employers in Shakopee. One of the unique things that we've seen grow since starting the service is also an interest in using this service for entertainment purposes to get from Shakopee to Mall of America, as well as onto the airports. As has previously been mentioned, the bulk of the funding has been spent to put the service on the road. We did not purchase additional equipment. We've been using retired buses to make the service successful, and MDTA has also committed in its 2017 budget to continue the service. Quickly before moving on to the next slide, just to highlight a couple of successes. We had over 26,000 door hangers that were distributed in Shakopee to provide free rides to promote the service. We've had over 60,000 impressions through social media. Those are things like being liked and commenting and sharing the link. We had a digital billboard on Cedar Avenue advertising the service. We've had over 15 commuter fairs where our staff was out promoting the service and talking with employees about how they could use the service. And we also have over 100 employees enrolled in the regional MetroPass transit benefit program. Moving on to the next slide, the most important success, I believe, from this service has been how we've been able to build our relationships with partners, and especially the employees. We have formed some unique partnerships with Amazon, Mystic Lake Casino and Hotel, and we've also been in conversations with St. Francis regarding local infrastructure. Amazon was one of the first employers to commit to the project. They have been on board since service began in August, and as a result, they have a direct stop for some of their select trips that are most used by their employees. One of their critical times was through the holiday season of 2016, and we believe that our service helped both their employees, and then because of their shifts and their schedules, we saw a ridership boost. In December of 2016, Mystic Lake Casino became a key partner by revising their service, which was formerly provided by Casino Hotel, and they operated trips throughout the region to pick up their employees. They modified that to operate a direct shuttle service between Marshall Road and Mystic Lake Casino Hotel, and then relied on this Route 495 service to bring people out to Shakopee. And so that's a critical example of how some of the last mile solutions can become successful through public transit and employers working together. And then in closing, just wanted to highlight some of the ridership numbers that we've seen. This graphic shows the tail end of 2016, where the red break shows the ridership boost that resulted when Mystic Lake Casino transitioned their employees onto Route 495 and started their shuttle. We saw a high average weekday ridership the week right before Christmas, and weekday ridership was about 200 to 10 per day. Weekend ridership was 190 average per day, and we've actually held pretty steady for the month of January. We're just about 200 average weekday ridership and 180, 190 for weekends. Total ridership since service began is over 23,000, which STA has been pleased with. And we look at ways to continue to grow service, and one of those ways is to continue to seek those last mile solutions and capital needs and additional funding for this route.
Very good. A final comment, Mr. Clark?
No, Mr. Chair, just thank you for your attention. We're happy to answer any questions that the committee
has. I have a couple quick questions myself before I go on to members. First, where did you get the name 495?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, we started out with a project 494, so we added one to it and got 495.
And to add on to that, there is a regional convention for putting a route number out there, and so we tried to be consistent with the conventional numbering. Didn't want to do 494 again because of the previous projects, and I think in some people's minds they'd like to call it Shakopee Express or something flashy, but for now it's the 495.
Oh, very good. And can you tell me what is the distance covered of this bus route?
That's a great question. I believe it's 15 to 20 miles. I don't have that number off the top of my head, but we can get it for you.
So it's longer than a light rail route anyway. That's important. If I realize you used some of your existing equipment to establish this route, any idea what it would cost to establish this route if you were starting from scratch? I realize that may be a stretch to estimate that.
Mr. Chair, perhaps it would be helpful. When we first came to the legislature 2 years ago for funding for this route, the request was $6.5 million, and that included a higher frequency of travel as well as the capital, the new buses, to provide that service. So I don't know if that's helpful, but that was the original request, was $6.5 million, and we received $2 million 2 years ago.
$6.5 million for 15 miles. I like it. On to the next, the previous slide of this one, you talked about sponsorships or working with employers. Do they contribute financially to the project?
In some cases, yes, and in some cases, no. It depends on the employer, and there are some of those details where I'm not sure how much we can share. James, I'm going to
refer to Mr. Chair, I would just say that, as Jen mentioned earlier, or Ms. Lehman mentioned earlier, Mystic Lake has changed the way that they were getting their employees to work, so they are now picking folks up at the Marshall Transit Station, bringing them to Mystic Lake. As far as Amazon is concerned, I think there might be a financial contribution. We would love to have these employers come back and visit with your community in a couple of weeks when we have our request for additional funding for this this service, Mr. Chair. And I'm sure they'd be happy to answer that for you.
Thank you. We have a question from a number of questions. Members, we're going to try to be done with this by a quarter after, so help me keep an eye on the clock. Representative Bernardi.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. My first question is, what is your present fare recovery, and if you two needed to meet the 80% recovery rate by 2022, how would you go, you know, what would you have to do and how would it affect your service?
So is that your bill, Representative Bernardi? You're so fond of it?
I looked it up online, and it's Representative Uglin's bill.
I see.
Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Thank you for that. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Bernardi. It really does depend on the mode of service, whether it's dial-a-ride service or if it's express service, but the average fare box recovery would be anywhere from 21% to as high as 33%. I think the national average, from what I understand, is roughly 30%, so I think the 33% is above average. And as far as how we would meet an 80% recovery, I don't have a good answer for you right now. I think if you can imagine where we are now, where it's at, you know, at best 33%, I think 80% would be very difficult to reach.
And then, Mr. Chair, my final
question. A follow-up question, okay. Bernard.
Okay.
If I could just add, the idea of the fare recovery is kind of a new idea to us, but what I will tell you is that there is currently a committee as part of the Met Council where we do look at regional fares, and we are in the process of putting that committee together to begin to look at these types of impacts as to what we can and cannot do. So right now it's a little premature to give you a definitive answer, but we are working toward arriving at an answer for that question.
And then, Mr. Chair, I have people in my district, well, one person in particular who's been unemployed for 2 years and was interested in working at Amazon. Do you, is there any partnerships or collaboration between Metro Transit and getting people to Amazon with your service?
Go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, there is. That's why we went to the Mall of America, because Metro Transit serves to the Mall of America. So that becomes kind of a hub area where ridership from their service can come and then pick up on our service. So there is that, and we did work with Metro Council to, again, when we chose the Mall of America as one of our starting points.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my question is similar, but it's more specific to the 495 demonstration project. Is what is do we have a numbers on the fare box recovery on that route?
Mr. Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Process of elimination. Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I don't know what the fare box recovery is. We can come back. We will present on the 495 project in more detail in the coming weeks, and we'll have that information for you.
Thank you. We look forward to that. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the 495 demonstration project, was this the Albrightville, that suburb-to-suburb demonstration project?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman. Yes, it was.
So, Mr. Chair,
follow-up, Representative Hausman.
There was a big article in the newspaper about that, and I thought they were going to discontinue it because they only had one or two riders over a number of weeks, and they said, well, we can't do this anymore.
Mr. McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, when we received that money, we took it as a very serious stewardship of the state's money. One of the things that we looked at was we put a lot of metrics in place before we started the route. How do we determine if it's a success or not? What the early numbers began to show us was that it was not a success, and then what we looked at was why wasn't it a success, because at the time we asked for the money, there definitely was a demand to move from suburb to suburb. What we discovered and what we got feedback from was that while there is a demand to move from suburb to suburb, there is a thing known as the last mile. And the problem is all these businesses are not built around a transit station. So now you have to move people from a transit station to their jobs. We have since addressed that issue, and that's why on the 495 route we were having much more success, because we did manage to get business to buy in. We also looked at what individual users could do as far as shuttle buses. You can't take a coach bus from a transit station and go around where all the businesses are at. So we put a lot of things in place to make 495 a success, and what the numbers are showing us is that it is a success. And what we intend to do, again, moving forward, is we will go back to probably the 494 route, but now we will have learned our lessons, and we will put in place things at that point to make that a success. But right now we can't do that because that will require additional capital that we just do not have. So all we can do is finish up this project, report back to the committee as to what we've learned, how successful it was, and then kind of go from there.
And then if I could, Mr. Chair, just one final. The subsidy per passenger on each of these four lines was one thing I was going to request, but when you said this last thing, I thought, before you come back for more, I think we should know what's the subsidy per passenger on this 495 as well. I'm assuming you don't have those numbers now?
Mr. Clark.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, as I just mentioned to Representative Nelson, we'll be happy to provide those numbers. We don't have them today.
This isn't the fare box recovery. This is the subsidy per passenger.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, both of those.
That would be something different.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a number of new people on the committee this year, and maybe would either of you be comfortable just telling how this used to be, how we used to get the revenue to operate the opt-outs and the changes that were made a few years ago.
Thank you. Briefly, Mr. Clark.
Yes.
Well, Representative Clark, I guess, is appropriate too, isn't it?
No. Mr. Chair, Representative Faison, Yes, there is a long story. And, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, if I would just for a moment, I'll probably embarrass Representative Mason, but Representative Mason is a former chair of NVTA and also a former, I believe, a former chair of SDA as well.
I was on the board when we started it.
Thank you. And so it was in part because of your hard work that we're sitting here today. So thank you. Mr. Chair, prior to 2001, the suburban providers received both operating and capital funding through the property tax. In the 2001 tax bill that was removed, the operating for the suburban providers comes through the MVEST, the motor vehicle sales tax. There was a snapshot taken in 2001 on what the providers were receiving in property tax, and that was transferred over to the motor vehicle sales tax.
Thank you for that information. We have a final question from Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this just kind of sticks out there, and I'm kind of Captain Obvious. So I see Southwest Transit, and I think Southwest Rail Line, and I'm going, what would the impact of Southwest Transit be once that becomes a reality?
Mr. McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. Well, what I can tell you is I was directly involved in all the negotiations between Southwest Transit, the Met Council, and everything about light rail. There will be zero impact. What we have negotiated is that what Southwest provides is basically an express transit service from Eden Prairie to downtown. What light rail will provide is a transit service that will have numerous stops. I believe it's in the neighborhood of 12 stops. Southwest Transit can move from Eden Prairie to downtown in about 20 minutes. The light rail is going to take closer to 50 minutes.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the reason that's great that if that happens, but in my experience, I used to ride the 94B right down here to the Capitol, and it used to take me 22 minutes. Once that rail line went in, that route disappeared or changed dramatically to where I was forced to take that. So if that actually happens for you, great, but that's not been my experience.
Well, Mr. McDonald.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I can address that. Part of the difference is that you were also dealing with Metro Transit, which controlled not only the light rail but also the bus. What we have negotiated is a separation of basically operations between the two. That's why I say there will be zero effect, because we will continue to operate out of Eden Prairie Station, our express, to go downtown. So that's why I can say with all confidence there is no impact. They do not control our schedule, and we do not control their schedule.
Thank you. With that, we are out of time. Thank you for your presentation today. We look forward to seeing you again in the very near future.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up, we have Metro Mobility. Looking good. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Judd Shetton. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Met Council. I appreciate the opportunity for us to be able to talk a little bit more about Metro Mobility. With me today is Nick Thompson, who is in charge of that part of the Council's transit work. And a week or two ago, we gave this presentation in Representative Runbeck's committee, and we appreciate the fact that we get to be here before the full Finance Committee to talk about the Metro Mobility Service, and in particular some of the financial pressures that we are feeling currently due to the growth in metro mobility, and look forward to being able to answer some of those questions so that we have some context related to what metro mobility really means as far as our upcoming budget negotiations, hopefully. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Nick.
Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nick Thompson with the director at Met Council. Thank you for the opportunity to present Metro Mobility today. We thought it was important to describe the service of Metro Mobility, what it is, how it is different than other transit services, and what guides the design of the service before we get into a discussion about the budget and the trends related to that. What Metro Mobility is, it's a shared ride, door-through-door public transportation service for those with disabilities that are unable to use regular route transit. A couple key terms here is door-through-door means the driver of Metro Mobility will escort the passenger from the through the door of where they start their trip onto the bus, and then once they complete the trip, they'll assist them to their final destination in the door. So it is a different type of service. It's the eligibility of who can use this service is determined by persons with a disability that are unable to use transit service. It is not about their ability to drive a car or not. Passengers can expect to share a ride with other passengers if it works within the performance targets. And we designed the service to try to match the ride time for a regular route bus service, not the ride time for a passenger vehicle. So looking through the history, it's important to understand the history of the service, how it's changed, and some key points that has developed into the system that we have today. It started as a pilot project to provide mobility in 1976. In 1979, it became called, as it grew, the system grew to St. Paul and Minneapolis, is where we started to call it Metro Mobility, and provided under about 200,000 trips per year at that time. In context, we have grown to over 2 million trips per year. In 1990, the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed that really guided how paratransit services across the country operate and kind of dictated some of the rules that we have. Though, because we had a service that was very similar, we were prepared and the Metro Mobility Service to expand, but it was really operated very much within the guidelines of ADA at the time. We've continued to try to find efficiencies in the service, so over time we've changed the service in 1993. We attempted to privatize the entire Metro Mobility Service. Unfortunately, it didn't work very well. Within 5 days, we had problems with the provider, ride, software, and the governor at the time asked that the National Guard be called in to provide the service. So that is a kind of an example of how important the service is for riders. After that, 1994 is really the system that is in place in the model today. The Met Council took over that service, where we would provide the services at a core and have a designated service areas across the required area. In 2005, we changed the service to require that you are certified as a rider to use the service. And in 2006 is where we're going to talk about in detail, but there's a federal area for Metro Mobility Service. In 2006, at the state level, they set the area of boundaries for the Metro Mobility Service to match the transit taxing district that existed in 2006. And the difference between the federal requirements and the state 2006 statute, we're going to go into detail because they really guide how we can efficiently deliver the service and the difference in service areas. We have tried to find different ways to make this more efficient. In 2014, we implemented a major technology system that allowed us to really dynamically route and do much more efficient at our routing that helped with cost. And in 2015, we completely redesigned the service model, changed the service from 5 providers to 3, and that's allowed us to get better contracted rates. As I mentioned, there's a federal and a state area. The federal area in green on your screen is the area that really the federal ADA law dictates. That is the area that's tied to the existing base service of fixed route service. And then the blue area is the area beyond that federal area that existed on January 1st, 2006 in the transit taxing district. There's a little bit of the federal area that has grown outside of that taxing district as some of the fixed route has expanded over time. But really, as we get into detail, I'll describe these two. But it's important to understand these two areas when you describe the costs and the pressures and the flexibility for changes in service that we have.
And Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to jump in here real quick just to provide a little bit more context related to the footprint that was put into place in 2006. That was brought forward by Representative Holberg in the House and Senator Murphy in the Senate. We were at a position at that point in time where we had a significant budget shortfall, and what the legislature was interested in doing was making sure that those folks who were potentially going to see their Metro Mobility service reduced, because a couple of the bills included large-scale service reductions. It was in order to put this in place so if there was a Metro Mobility certified rider who, depending on whatever, I guess independent of whatever the legislature did as far as our broader transit funding, that those folks would be able to have a reliable a ride based on where they lived at the time. And so the footprint remains. It passed unanimously in the House and passed unanimously in the Senate. And so the important piece here is also just to show that the amount of service we provide in our system outside of the federally mandated area.
So when you look at those two areas, the federally mandated area and the expanded state area, they really have two different requirements, sets of requirements. I'll go through those in detail here. The first is the goal. Federally set, it needs to be comparable to regular route service. It's for those that are unable to use regular route service. And this goal for the state area was just to provide greater access to those who have other don't have other transit options or cannot use regular transit. From a certification standpoint, at the federal level, you have to certify the users that they are unable to use regular route transit, and at the state level, there is no certification requirement. The service area is anywhere there is a fixed route service. In the federal level, we provide Metro Mobility service to anybody that's trips within 3/4 mile of that service. And at the state level, it is the boundaries, as we mentioned, that were set in 2006. So we're required at a minimum to do curb-to-curb and door-to-door upon individual, so individuals can request at the federal level for individual door-to-door. We make an attempt to do door-to-door for everyone, except if they ask not to be escorted. But almost all riders do need an escort from door-to-door service. The hours of operation for Metro Mobility in the federal area match the hours of operation for the service in that area. In the greater state area, there is no, but we do provide kind of a standard service that matches weekdays 6 to 6 if there's no route, and then weekends more limited service of 8 to 4 on weekends. There is something, a term called capacity restrictions. This is where the services are very different. In the federal area, there can be no denial of a trip. If a trip is requested, we will provide it. So as demand grows, we match that demand. We do have more flexibility in the state area. There can be trips that are denied, though we try to meet those trips that are requested, because this is a service that is, for many of the riders, it's the only availability they have for transportation. Trips do need to be scheduled in advance. There is not, per se, same-day requests for trips, with a few exceptions. But so we generally require that trips be scheduled 1 to 4 days in advance across both service areas. How you meet the service requirements is we have a little flexibility, but if you request, for example, a trip to be picked up at 9 a.m., we have an hour on either side of 9 a.m. to meet that requirement. So we try to match close to 9, but for our routing efficiency, we can pick you up as early as 8 or as late as 10 in that service request if it was, for example, at 9 o'clock. The fares in the federal area are dictated that we cannot exceed 2 times the base fare. We are slightly less than that, but a Metro Mobility customer pays $3 for a fare in the off-peak or $4 in the peak. We could charge up to $3.50 or $4.50. But we have to find a balance between the affordability of the service and what the max we can charge. We do not set any restrictions on trip purpose, and we cannot at the federal level. No matter what the trip is, what the demand is, we are required to meet that demand and serve that trip purpose. We do not prioritize and cannot prioritize, for example, a doctor's trip over a grocery store trip. All those trips are required to be met. We have more flexibility at the state level.
I'm going to interrupt you briefly. Representative Howell, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it comes to that certification when it looks at unable to use regular route. Is that because of the location of the regular route, or is that because the route on the regular bus is not accessible? What does that mean, I guess, unable to use the regular route?
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, all our regular route is accessible service, but for some reason there's a disability the individual has, and there's a variety of disabilities that prevents them from safely using regular route service. So they may need a personal assistant, they may need a driver to escort them or help them get on the bus. And so there's a variety of reasons, but they are certified individually that they have some disability that prevents them from using the regular route for their travels.
Follow-up, Representative Howell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd sometime like to get an example because I used to drive a similar bus, and I'm stretching my imagination why they couldn't ride a regular bus given the current bus routes and the capabilities of our current bus structure.
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we'd be happy to get some specific examples, but generally they went through a process at an individual level that has proven that they cannot safely ride or get on or off a bus without some assistance or for some disability that the individual has. So each one is individually certified.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the question was, when you talked about the trip request on this slide, you said 1 to 4 days. The slide says 1 to 14 days. And I guess just
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the federal requirements allow us to go up to 14 days request, but for efficiency reasons and what the general, some of the customers want, we find that 1 to 4 days is sufficient to do the scheduling. And so that's what we've set, but we have to.
It just jumped out of
there.
Representative Rundbeck.
I'm considering my question, but right. I'll just mention it. I mean, we've all heard the examples, you know, of a trip, say, a frequent trip by Metro Mobility to the liquor store, you know. And so I'm just curious. So I realize you can't say no, but, I mean, I guess it just seems like, well, that's interesting. You know, it's a couple blocks. Mm-hmm. But so you're not judging, and anything is fine.
Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, I would say we are blind to whatever the trip is. So if it's the church, to the liquor store, to wherever, if that person is a certified rider and they make an appointment for a ride, we provide it. And that is required by law, and we cannot pass any type of judgment over what type of ride anybody's taking. It is just provided.
Well, thank you, Mr. Shetland. Please go ahead with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. So by the numbers, if you look at the program at an annual level, in the past year was a little over $56 million to provide this service, all state-funded for the service. Over 2.2 million rides are preliminary numbers from 2016, which represents about a 6% growth over the previous year. We have over 40,000 riders that are certified to use this service. It's operated across four different providers with 530 vehicles. The Met Council purchases those vehicles for the providers, but that is the size of the fleet. Serves over 93 different communities under four separate contracts. So if you look at the customer profile, this is what we're looking at when we're trying to project growth, is that there's two types of customers in general. Those under the age 65 are they use the service much more frequently. These are often school or work-based trips. As the customer base is older, this is a customer base that's growing quite large as the demographic is shifting to an older population. They use the service throughout life, but they're less frequent users as you get older. So it's kind of two different profiles of user base. But it's those older riders that we see a lot of growth in and we expect it in the future. In terms of that operating cost, this is a service, as you know, driven by the fact that we must meet demand. We do not deny trips. and the population that we're serving is growing. You see growth that averages nearly 6% per year. We're seeing growth both, and it's a service that, as you add a rider, you almost add that extra cost. It's almost a one-for-one cost for every rider. It's hard to become efficient or group rides and things like that because of the requirements of meeting demand, of on-time performance, of servicing within a time window. And so as any rider we grow by that operating cost for that rider over time. To the point by 2020, we're expecting to be almost at $90 million per year for this service based on the growth and nearing 3 million trips per year.
And, Mr. Chair, I'd like to jump in here as well and just mention to the committee that currently from the legislature we receive $89.8 million per year in general fund assistance, and currently we put about $56.5 million of that per year toward our metro mobility requirements. This graph shows that within the next, not this biennial budget, but the following biennial budget, Metro Mobility will eat the entire general fund that we get today base by itself. And so I want to remind folks that we have no choice but to provide this. We are happy to provide it. It is a important service that we need to make sure that folks have this mobility. For many people, it is their only mobility. But this is just an opportunity for us to make sure the committee understands that the service has a cost to it, and that cost is growing along with the amount of people that are going to be using the service. We talked about this a little bit in the policy committee, but the way that we budget, we've got the state has to pay 50% of the light rail operations. Second, I guess, look at the triage takes us down to Metro Mobility, which is federally required. So the last piece that gets funded is the bus system. And what happens when we look at that is the bus system is operating just fine, but when we have the growth come in, particularly from Metro Mobility, if we don't have additional funds, it comes out of the bus system. And that is a concern that we have. It's a concern we want to make sure that the committee understands so we can have that conversation here with you over the next couple months, because it really is something that we need to figure out how to address Metro Mobility, because that line, while it ends at 2020, is going to continue to go up and up and up. And so I just wanted to put that in the back of your head here as we move forward into the budget discussion.
Mr. Chair, members, a couple of measures here that we look at comparing our service, how we're doing. This has one of our fare box recovery has been discussed in the committee on different services today. Metro Mobility recovers just in the past year about less than 11% of the fare through the fares from customers. So it's a very expensive service. Customers are paying a much higher fare than the base fare of a regular route service, but we still have a fare box recovery that is quite low for a transit service. So we also try to compare ourselves to peers. You know, with federal ADA law, a paratransit service like this operates in all the major cities, so we can compare to peers. We are very efficient in terms of our costs compared to a lot of our peer cities. If you look at the scale, this is a recent study that is underway as we're trying to understand where we can find efficiencies and what our comparisons are. We compare very well to what you'd say is very similar services in other cities because they're guided by the same federal ADA law. But as you see, for all of these cities, it's a very expensive service to provide. So now the challenges that we see with this is, again, the rising costs that we've shown in terms of ridership, and with that, for each new rider is added cost. The rising demand, roughly a 6% year-over-year growth, very steady 6% growth in demand. We are facing with our drivers, we are in a very competitive market. We are having a hard time finding drivers. At the current pay scale, on average, a new driver starts at about $14 per hour. That is not competitive with other driving services in the metro area. And so we would see, to meet the demand, we might have to go up to as high as $16 per hour, and that will, of course, have increased costs on the service. We're seeing some increasing length of trips by the customers as they're requesting these trips. Any longer trip increases the cost of the trip and the efficiency of the service. And lastly, there are some requirements at the federal level that are driving some of the costs for the performance standards that we must meet on this. We must meet, for example, on-demand or on-time service of 95%. That's one that we are meeting just barely, but there are other new requirements like how long a customer is on hold, example, that are being tightened up that are driving up some of our costs. So these are all major challenges that we see to the service that are driving costs and making it a challenge to us to meet the demands of the customer base.
Thank you.
And with that, I'd open for any standpoint.
Thank you very much for your presentation. A quick question from the chair. As far as the destination for these passengers, are they restricted to destinations within the service area?
Mr. Chair, members, the trip has to start or end within the service area. Almost all the trips are within the service area, but there's some that can end outside of the service area.
And is there a limitation as to how far outside the service area they can end?
Mr. Chair, no. We have had a few trips that are, 40, 50 miles long, but almost all of them are in the average of 10 miles. So they're trips that are very near to the destination.
But that's not restricted by the rules of your operation?
Mr. Chair, no. And if you think about that service area that is the state-mandated area, we can do we have a lot more flexibility in trip requirements on that, because there isn't a restriction, so we could have a different fares per distance. We could have different distance-based fares for that area and other restrictions in that area. We have more flexibility.
Thank you. Representative Hausman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On Days on the Hill, we always learn something about a particular issue, and every time there is a Day on the Hill for members of the disability community and they are in my office, I always ask the same question. Would you rather have Metro Mobility or would you rather have a well-funded, comprehensive public mass transit system? And without a doubt, they'd prefer the comprehensive public mass transit system because then they'd have freedom like everyone else. I mean, when you think about the restrictions of these, planning days in advance and then even the pickup and drop-off, they are imprecise. It's not, you're mandated to do it, and it's not necessarily the one they would choose if they had another option.
Well, and Mr. Chair, and Representative Hausman, we would like that as well, because what happens is that the per passenger subsidy for a Metro Mobility ride is about 8 to 10 times what it is on our regular transit system. So the point I was making earlier about if we don't fund the bus system and we don't find a way to fund Metro Mobility, we have to fund Metro Mobility, so the bus system continues to shrink, which means we'll have more people dependent on Metro Mobility, and that service costs so much more. Where if we could move those to Representative Howe's point, of course, we would like to have people be able to use the regular bus service, but we're not in a position to be able to tell them to choose one or the other if they are certified with that disability.
I think Representative Howell has something to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, my Representative Hausman, that's my issue. If the regardless of whether the regular bus route is expanded out there or not, these people can't use that route. Otherwise, they couldn't get certified to use this system. Figure that out wrong? I guess I'm confused on the certificate that they can't use the regular service, I guess.
You can relieve Representative Howell of his confusion.
That might not be possible, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair and Representative Howell, if a person has an ADA-certified disability and they are certified through Metro Mobility, they can use Metro Mobility, but that person could also choose to use the regular transit system if they are capable of it.
Representative Hausman, do you have something
Yes, I
to
wanted
add?
To clarify. In other words, what I would say right now, we don't have a comprehensive, well-funded public mass transit system. We have really we're just barely kind of scraping along. What I was comparing it to, I said, given a choice, if you had the kind of system that was really comprehensive, that would take you anywhere. Now we have huge gaps in our service, and I was comparing it to something that really doesn't exist yet. But they said, if given druthers, they would still rather have that as our goal.
Thank you. I have a number of questions on the list. I'm going to try and get through them very quickly, but we're about out of time. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just ask for a follow-up. If you give that to us or send it to us, but
in regards to your subsidy per passenger trip, and you had the comparison from other states and other cities, and you had it based upon per trip rather than per passenger mile, which seems to me that that would be more realistic looking at what the costs are. And I know that you have that information for some other areas. So if you could just pass on to the committee sometime how you rank in regards to actual costs per passenger mile in regards to Metro Mobility, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll ask my question, and maybe you can just send us this info too, but you mentioned that you had contracts and you partner with outside providers. If you could send us who those partners are or those providers and the process for going about either an RFP for those contracts or just some information around how you make those decisions. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you could go back a couple of slides to the differential between ridership and cost, I think. It was two lines. One was, that's it. Thank you. So when you said that there's a labor disparity that you're trying to get over in terms of wage versus that sort of thing, and assuming that you will have to step up to the wage pressure, that green line has a new vector, right? And can you give me some sense of how much differential, because a wage range, a change of $2 over 14 is about 14%. I don't know if I'm, you're faster at math than I probably am, or at least you got a younger brain than I do.
Which of you has a younger brain?
No, I'm going to answer that question. And I appreciate the question, Mr. Chair. What we will do is follow up with you. I don't want to give the committee something off the top of my head, and I don't want to put Nick in that spot either, but we'll be happy to provide that to the committee. I think the point that you're making is that it is going to be an added cost, and so when we look at that in terms of we're having that issue today, and if we're able to find a competitive workforce to be able to provide that ride, it just adds to that, to those costs.
Thank you. A final brief question from Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Thompson. I guess our drivers, employees of Met Council, or of the respective contracted firms.
Mr. Thompson,
Mr. Chair, Representative, they are employees of the respective contracted firms and hired by those firms.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation, members. This meeting is adjourned.